Good evening. I'm almost off duty. I thought I would, first of all, thank you all for being here. And second, I thought I would pose a question that my friend Ellen asked me. Does anyone miss the Sheraton? Yeah, that was kind of my reaction too. What's there to miss? I wanted to... I wanted to start with the many thank yous that are due to the hands that make this event happen. It does take a village to put it all together. I couldn't possibly in any way do it all alone. So I wanted to thank Sunstone staff members, Carol Quist, Stephen Carter, Holly Welker, Catherine Hess, Michael Stevens. He does a few things around the office. I also want to thank our intrepid audio and video team, Richard. Yay! And Wade Greenwood. You don't get to see Wade very often because he's typically hiding in a back room editing audio and burning CDs and running around changing chips in the recorders. So his is a task that needs extra thanking, and we really appreciate all the work that you've done to make the audio happen this year. It's wonderful. And we also need to thank our volunteer corps. Most of them are named in the program, so I won't rattle off the names because I'm sure I will forget someone, but you've seen them at the registration desk. You've seen them roaming around taking photos of people. Did you catch anybody napping this year, Steve?
Yes.
Ah. Look for that on Facebook in a couple of days. So we're very grateful to all the people who have a hand in making this event happen and run smoothly and take care of our many constituents. I would also like to thank the folks who put in matching funds grants this year. We have a total of $6,600 in the matching funds pot. Our fundraising as of Friday night brought us to $3,800, which will be matched dollar for dollar. And since yesterday, our accountant says we're now up to $4,245. So we're very close to meeting that goal, and we have till the end of August to get all the way there. So we thank you to all those who have made extra contributions to Sunstone and who have put money in the matching funds pot. So we thank you. And I also have to say thank you to Weber State's amazing events and conferences staff and the catering folks who are here taking care of us tonight. This has been This year's symposium started out as kind of a nightmare when I found out in mid-February that the Sheraton was canceling our contract and I would have to find a new place to have Sunstone. And that was scary, and it took a long time to emerge from the fetal position after getting that news. And thanks to my connections at Weber State through Mike, we were put in very good hands. The folks here have been responsive to every problem, and there have been like two, you know, I'd call them, they would send somebody to a room that, you know, needed help getting the audio visual stuff set up or a room that needed to be unlocked or just anything. They were, you know, I would make a phone call and they were there. And they really have spoiled me for ever going anywhere else. And if you have strong feelings about where Sunstone is, please make sure to grab a survey form and fill it out and let us know what you think of the venue, what you think about the idea of coming back here again, whether you'd prefer to stay in Salt Lake. We want to hear feedback and make plans based on what you're interested in. So let us know what you're interested in. We have a couple of post-symposium events. The first one is the post-banquet after-party at mine and Mike's home. Balloon Moroni is already there. So I'm thinking we might have a little fun with him tonight, either in the yard or maybe we can take him on some field trips around Ogden and take pictures. It'll be fun. You should show up. The address and the phone number, if you need directions, are printed in the final program. We also have Sunday services at the Community of Christ Church in Ogden. There are flyers like this out on the registration desk if you need directions. The address is also printed in the final program. Sunday school begins at 10 a.m. and the sacrament service begins at 11, and they are serving lunch at noon. So all are welcome to attend and join in that worship and celebration tomorrow morning. One note about the dates for next year. We already have those picked out. We will be meeting at the University of Utah's Olpen Student Union July 25th through the 28th. We also already have next year's theme picked out, and it's published in this year's final program. We will be taking an especially close look at Mormons and Mormonism as a political force. And political being that whole idea writ large, not just partisan party politics, but the personal as political, how Mormons exercise power, what their relationship is to power, and how they get things done in the political arena. So I'm sure it will be an interesting topic for us to explore in more detail. And with that, I think I'm done with all the housekeeping and announcements. So I will introduce the moderator for tonight's discussion. Dr. Colleen McDaniel is a professor of history and the Sterling M. McMurrin Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Utah, and is one of the foremost experts on religion in the United States. And her... Her book, Material Christianity, urges scholars to look at the stuff of religion for new evidence on how people live their faith. And she is bookending this conference. She spoke about religion and material culture in our opening lecture on Wednesday night. And so she's here to moderate the discussion for our panel tonight, entitled Treasures of Heaven on Earth, The Impact of Mormonism's Missing, Repudiated, Rebuilt, and Museum-Sequestered Artifacts. And given this year's theme on Mormon artifacts and material culture, we took a closer look at the religious stuff that we're involved with, that Mormons create, and that we build into our religious lives, our homes, our churches. And we wanted also to talk about the artifacts that aren't here. You know, in some ways we take the material culture around us for granted. It's something that we don't see until, you know, there's a theme and you can focus on it and say, hey, well, how does material culture play into my religious life or praxis? And so we also wanted to say, well, what about the absence of significant artifacts in Mormonism. What does that mean? What happens if they're lost or okay, I'm stealing Colleen's thunder. So I better stop talking and let her get into the details of that. Thank you.
I really was getting worried there that she was just going to, you know, give my speech and then I'd stand up here and have nothing to say. And so our wonderful ending panel, at the end of a very long and hopefully productive and exciting and probably fun symposium for all of you. Just a couple of quick words about the topic that they'll be speaking of this evening. So as Mary Ellen was telling you, this last session, which you can read about in the program, is about what happens when material culture is not quite there. What happens when it gets lost or misplaced? So one of the interesting things about the study of things is that material culture tends to be fixed. It tends to be physical. You can see something, you can touch it, you can smell it, you can feel it. Sometimes you can even taste it. You know, you've all had a lovely banquet meal and hopefully you're ready for an interesting panel. So the question is, what happens when that's not there? What happens when things and objects and landscapes disappear? Part of the problem is that it's very misleading, material culture. We think it's fixed. We think that it doesn't change. But material culture, just like ideas, is always in process. It's always in change. So we don't want to be misled to think that just because we can touch it and feel it, that somehow it doesn't move. Objects are not fixed and stable. So the panelists are going to be looking at the mobility and mutability of material culture. They're going to be looking at absence, what happens when something is missing. Now, we all know we live in an American culture that stresses the new. We like things which are fashionable. And that always is a problem for material culture. You know, how do you maintain one set of objects if the fashion is for a different set of objects? So American culture is also a transient culture. We move from place to place. We rebuild things. We rebrand things. What happens in the process of doing that? So the panelists will also be looking at the transient nature of material culture. And I think the final thing that they'll be talking about and that hopefully will undergird their general discussion is a question of power dynamics. Who benefits when a space or an object is reconfigured? Who controls what's lost or, the converse, what's preserved? Who restricts access to spaces and objects? And who defines authenticity? You know, material culture, if it's determined to be not authentic, well, then maybe it should go to the trash can instead of the museum. So all of these are the questions I think the panelists will discuss in one way or the other this evening. And the way that I'd like to arrange this is, I will introduce each of them as they come up by only saying a couple of words that are not in your program, a little bit of information that is new, and then they will give their presentations of 10 or 15, 20 minutes, and then we will have a panel discussion and, if need be, answer some questions. All right? Thank you. So let's bring the panelists up, and we will begin the way that they are in the program. That sounds good. All right, our first speaker this evening is Dale Luffman. He is the Ecumenical and Interfaith Officer of the Community of Christ. And I asked him to tell me a little something about him that was not in the program. And he told me that he has three red-headed grandchildren who currently live in Mali in West Africa. His son is in the Foreign Service. And when he's not writing papers like he's going to give you today, he's thinking about his grandchildren and his son far away in West Africa. I thought that was up there on wonderful things. So, Dale, if you'd like to begin.
For some reason, I always have to adjust things. Well, it's good to be here and to have these moments of kind of closure and celebration and one more time to reflect on things together. Arguably, one of the most important artifacts of Mormonism, the object on which its existence seems to rest, is missing. We do not have the golden plates, and only a few have claimed to have seen them, though how these plates were seen is open to significant interpretation. Valuable because the material that they were supposedly made of, their supposed ancient origin, and their content, Camorra's treasure, has succumbed to a mass-produced text used for proselyting and instruction. And not only the plates, but the so-called Urim and Thummim is also missing, as well as some other artifacts associated with these items of Camorra's treasure. Question is, how is this to be explained? I guess I would suggest, in a most profound way, that it all depends on where one looks and what one is looking for. Mark Shearer and I have these periodic conversations about the perspective of a historian and that of a theologian. Mark thinks his job is harder than mine because anything I say just, you know, is very subjective and is not dependent on any evidence. But we do understand that they are two very different approaches, and I want to suggest to you that I probably am approaching things far more from the significance of a theologian than a historian, although you cannot always separate those two disciplines. The theologian will usually be a little more concerned with things as they appear relative to their significance of what they seem to represent. Faith, after all, as St. Anselm has said, seeks to understand. And so that's probably my biased spectacles that we will be looking through. So let me begin by saying that as far as I'm concerned, the traditional apologetic language used to tell the tale regarding the miraculous events surrounding the reception of Camorra's treasure has been relatively deceptive, but perhaps also wrong-headed. It does not take into account much about Joseph Smith's own life and that of his dysfunctional family and its environment and his compensatory agenda. I would suggest that Joseph Smith and his earliest converts to the Book of Mormon, even as it is being dictated and coming into being, that budding Christian primitivist movement that moment began to birth, were strongly influenced by social, political, cultural, and religious environmental elements of their times. One of the characteristics of their lives were that they lived in what some have deemed to be an enchanted world, a world of magic. Not the way we construe magic today in terms of something evil or get carried away with Harry Potter, but something that was descriptive of the world of the early 19th century in upstate New York. I believe there is no reasonable or responsible way to understand the advent of Latter-day Saintism and its early artifacts without exploring the issues of enchantment framed within the earliest expressions of faith, and that would include the Book of Mormon. Early 19th century peoples lived in a pre-scientific environment that was hard-pressed to provide clear answers to many of life's perplexing questions. Many of those issues, dilemmas, and problems pervaded their experience. They frequently looked to what Mark Shearer calls a parascientific solution. That is, divining rods. What Oliver Cowdery was told to use in order to receive inspiration. Seer stones, magic charts, sacred drawings, talismans, almanacs were all a part of this enchanted world. And such practices were not seen in their day and time as irrational or irreligious or strange, because that was the world that people inhabited. You see, a case could be made to suggest that the success of the church birthed in the womb of the Book of Mormon is at best in part attributable to the amazing relevance of the Book of Mormon narrative to the folk beliefs and people's search for theological relevance in perplexing times. Joseph Smith's own family, scholars have written for us, suggest that they engaged in many mystical dimensions that represent the early 19th century. Finding buried treasures held a great attraction for many. If one was successful, one would find release for a family from the burdensome debt that they were subject to. It's kind of like winning the lottery today. For treasure seekers, financial security was just one shovelful away. You see, kind of like the lottery. Treasure seeking lay at the intersection of the material world and the aspirations and desires of a religious seeker. These intersect critically in what we, I hope, are focusing on tonight. And Joseph Smith apparently inherited this interest of treasure seeking from his father. Now, understanding that Joseph Smith's treasure seeking had significance here, I want to quote from Mark Shearer. He says, "Treasure seeking activity is an important key to understanding the discovery, recovery, and translation process of the metallic plates of the Book of Mormon. When Joseph experienced the visions of deity, he experienced what was commonplace to his era and his community. I was fascinated when I read the definitive biography of Jonathan Edwards, who inhabited the New England expanse almost a century before the church ever was dreamed of. He went in the woods one day, as the biographer shares, dismounted from his horse, knelt in a wooded area, and had an experience that is very parallel to what Joseph had. It was not a unique experience of Joseph's. And close associates like Martin Harris continue to report faith-promoting testimonies about Palmyra treasure digging and the appearance of a heavenly spirit in his life, or in Joseph's life. seeking Cumorah's treasure took place, we often forget, annually at the time of the autumnal equinox. It was not until I was quite a mature adult that it dawned on me how significant that was. You see, that treasure was unattainable on his initial attempt to secure it. That was not unusual in an enchanted world, and there are a lot of descriptions of this. But treasures were always hard to secure. They were often called slippery. And the reception of a treasure on that day of September 22nd, 1827, correlates wonderfully with the world of enchantment and with the world of a religious seeker. Joseph is reported to have dug up a box that contained the plates on this auspicious date. Soon Smith would begin to translate the plates. It was claimed that a device was given him when he obtained Cumorah's treasure. That device was traditionally referred to as the Urim and Thummim. The dictation of an initial manuscript began in his home in Harmony, Pennsylvania. And in these early months, it is held that some characters were obtained from the plates and written down. Some of us were viewing those in some of our workshops this week. But following the loss of those 116 pages of dictated manuscript, many things changed. Neither the Urim and Thummim or the metallic plates seem to have had great significance for the resulting dictated text other than to create a story of origin. I've always found that to be curious. Seeing is believing, but feeling is truth, says Mark Scheer. 11 men were prepared by Joseph for visionary encounter. I want you to hear that language. 11 men were prepared by Joseph for visionary encounter. Careful analysis of the testimonies of the 3 and 8 witnesses, as well as their separate statement in the years that follow, strongly suggest the visionary nature of their experiences. All 11 witnesses, in addition to Joseph Smith Jr., shared a worldview that included guardian spirits protecting slippery treasures that moved through the earth and just beyond the reach of diggers or treasure seekers. Although none of them denied their visions of the plates, several admitted that the experience was seen through visionary eyes and not natural eyesight. This phenomenon, of course, is known as second sight, and this seeing with spiritual eyes was common to a description of the experience. John Gilbert, who was one of the printers in the print shop that published the Book of Mormon, related a conversation with Martin Harris. He said, "Martin was in the office when I finished setting up the testimony of the 3 witnesses. I said to him, 'Martin, did you see those plates with your naked eyes?' He goes on to say, Martin looked down for an instant, raised his eyes up, and he said, 'No, I saw them with a spiritual eye.' Later, Harris would claim to have seen them by the power of God." Notice the language. The language moves toward domestication, from the world of enchantment toward the world of domestication. We would have said, where I grew up, where language was not the King's English, he cleaned up his language. And yet, those who numbered among the 8 witnesses testified that they hefted metallic plates having an appearance of gold. Others thumbed these metallic plates while covered with cloth. One must ask, however, whether the object hefted was actually gold rather than a representative object depicting Cumorah's treasure, because no one actually saw them. There is a difference between the hefting reports that report those plates coming in at 40 to 50 pounds and what gold plates would actually weigh based on Smith's description, which would come in closer to 170 to 180 pounds. Perhaps we're on a firmer ground, and this is where I've come to my conclusion. Perhaps we're on firmer ground, far firmer ground, in claiming that the Book of Mormon was a 19th century work dictated by one who saw himself a seer becoming a prophet, becoming a second witness that Jesus is the Christ, the eternal God, manifesting himself unto all nations, and that the stories associated with the metallic plates are at best meant to be supportive of the narrative. They are imaginative construals and constructions told in its own time, not necessarily significant to the witness of the Book of Mormon and the message that it was intended to convey. But that talk of such things have been able to provide a record to explain the phenomenon.
I now have the great honor to introduce Mike Quinn, who is a very dear friend and who I consider to be the foremost expert of Mormon history in the United States. And you are very lucky to hear his words here today. And I've had a nice chat with him earlier in the afternoon, and it sounds like he was in several sessions, so you probably have seen a bit of him this summer, which is just really a wonderful opportunity. So since you all know him rather well, I will just say that I asked him to tell me again something special that he hadn't printed up in the program, and he said that he's working on an essay about the vulnerability of the Quorum of the Twelve during the Smoot investigation. So this is some of his new work. So, and we are anxious to hear your words.
For tonight's panel, I'll share some anecdotes about what I call peculiar personal artifacts of early Mormonism. As truth in advertising, I must admit that during my first years as a Mormon historian, I had no interest in artifacts. Written records were what I emphasized, but I eventually learned that by examining artifacts, we could have gained a very important understanding of what written records barely mention. Appropriately, my first experience with them concerned the best-known artifact of the first man. In 1921, the LDS Church's publishing house released Apostle Orson F. Whitney's book titled Saturday Night Thoughts, which stated, quote, "The ruins of Adam's altar are still to be seen in that part of the old New World now known as the state of Missouri, where they were identified by Joseph the seer in 1838, unquote. This referred to the prophet's designation of a certain valley in Davis County, Missouri, as Adam on Diamond. In Wilfred C. Wood's 1958 book, Joseph Smith Begins His Work, Volume 1, there was a photograph of this altar, or what was left of it, showing a tree surrounded by broken pieces of rock. Flash forward 11 years to my first visit in that region. The day after Christmas 1969, I began driving from Salt Lake City toward my military assignment in Washington, D.C. To relieve the boredom of that drive in the dead of winter, I decided to visit church history sites along the way. In the Liberty Jail's LDS Visitor Center in Missouri, I got into conversation with an Idaho farmer who was a missionary guide there with his wife. I told him that my next stop was going to be Adam on Diamond. "Oh, you don't want to go there now," this old guide said. "They haven't rebuilt Adam's altar yet." To the uncomprehending "what?" that he obviously expected from me, the guide continued, "You see, Nearly every Utah Mormon who visits the place takes a souvenir rock from Adam's altar, which is nearly gone by October. So in the spring, workers drive a pickup truck of rocks to Adam on Diamond and dump them next to the sign. He added with a smile, "Idaho Mormons ain't that gullible." Flash forward 8 years later from that experience to the living room of church patriarch Eldred G. Smith in Salt Lake City. His son Gary had invited me there to do an interview with his father about the history of the patriarchs who had been sustained as prophets, seers, and revelators in the LDS Church since the 1830s. Eldred G. Smith had custody of diaries, correspondence, and artifacts of their ancestor line back to Joseph Smith's brother, Hiram, and father, Joseph Smith Sr. I was eager to see these. That night, the patriarch showed me what he described as a Kabbalistic document that had been passed down from Joseph Smith Sr. to Hiram and from his widow to each eldest son in turn. Eldred asked me what I thought of it. Staring at this gold-colored parchment inscribed with numerous symbols and words in various languages, I said, "Well, it's certainly unusual." I didn't have a clue what it meant, and no idea why Joseph Smith Sr. had possessed something so strange in the early 19th century. Now, I wasn't totally ignorant of Kabbalah as a medieval Jewish system of occult knowledge. Still, I had absolutely no interest in such an arcane topic and quickly asked Patriarch Smith to show me the diary book or account book of his ancestor, Hiram. Now, that was evidence I could understand immediately and interpret. I was so tunnel visioned that I didn't even think of the talk LDS Institute Director Reed C. Durham had given to the Mormon History Association a few years earlier. I hadn't attended, but I had read a typescript of his emphasis on Joseph Smith's connection to the occult through an artifact, a Jupiter talisman, as he called it and as he described it and explained its meaning to the audience, a stunned audience, I believe, some of whose members are here even today. There were dots to connect, but I didn't see them while looking at this parchment in 1977. It would have been recognized by some non-Mormon scholars as a layman, quote unquote, that's the title, used in ritual magic. By mid-1985, I was no longer indifferent to such artifacts. Folk magic had become a subject of immense interest among Mormon historians, and I eagerly read Durham's talk as well as the groundbreaking work by Art De Hoyos Jr. This young Masonic scholar had already published photos of the gold-colored parchment, plus two other laymans passed down patriarchally from Joseph Smith Sr., ultimately to Eldred Smith, who had shown them to me. This opened up to me a new world, one that I did my best to understand and describe in the book Early Mormonism and the Magic World View. It had photos of the Smith family's three unusual parchments, and my research showed that their inscriptions and purposes had been described in occult handbooks readily available in the mid-1820s. As part of my research for that book, it was my privilege to hold in my hands other artifacts that are more generally known and revered as sacred by Mormons. This included two of Joseph Smith's seer stones. First, a small sandy-colored one, round one that I examined in Wilfred C. Wood's museum north of Salt Lake City and south of here. And second, a large greenish rocky seer stone that I held in my hands after it was transferred from the temporary custody of Princeton University's library to descendants of its Utah Pioneers owner en route to a private collector, where I think it still remains, and whose identity, by the way, I don't know. But luckily, I had photographs of it from the Princeton Library, and I actually held it in my hands. It was quite an unusual artifact. In the archives of the Community of Christ in Independence, Missouri, I also saw a dark-colored spherical seer stone that once belonged to Book of Mormon witness David Whitmer. I also examined and photographed three artifacts used for healing by early Mormons. These were shown to me by descendants of those who originally had them. First was Apostle Wilford Woodruff's beautifully designed handkerchief that Joseph Smith had blessed for the healing of sick by touching it to their foreheads. Second was John L. Butler's cape that the Mormon prophet blessed for his bodyguard to use for healing. Each of those I saw through the courtesy of a descendant of each man. In Salt Lake City's Daughters of Utah Pioneers Museum, I also examined and photographed the old black cane that Apostle Willard Richards used for healing the sick by touching them with it. Also at the DUP Museum, I held and photographed two of Brigham Young's prized artifacts. First, a dove and olive branch medallion that he received from Joseph Smith, and second, a bloodstone, quote unquote, encased in a gold frame, which Brigham used as an amulet for protection, according to statements by members of his family and as recorded in the DUP records of acquisition. In the LDS Museum of History, I stumbled across yet another unusual artifact of Joseph Smith, a serpent-headed walking cane. In its carvings, I saw echoes of the occult that were obvious in the Smith family's parchments and in Joseph Smith's Jupiter talisman. By contrast, other observers see only carved allusions to Jesus. And that is, in many ways, a principal part of this question of artifacts. We can examine them and their context, but very often they have multiple contexts and multiple possibilities of meaning. And in many ways, just as beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, with artifacts, meaning can be in the eyes of the beholder. Although its symbols are unknown to me, another beautiful artifact is among the illustrations in my Magic World book. It was a gold necklace and pendant that Joseph Smith gave to his plural wife, Eliza R. Snow, whom he married in 1842. The gold locket he gave to another plural wife, Flora Woodworth, in 1843 did not survive Emma's foot. The practice, Emma being the legal wife, the practices and faith objects represented by many of the above artifacts were well beyond my own experiences of religion. Nonetheless, from 1977 to 1987, I felt honored to examine those objects that were revered as sacred relics by their modern custodians and those who had preserved them. In significant ways, they are physical reminders to us of what, in a very different context, British historian Peter Laslett called the world we have lost. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Mike Reed, who will begin a PhD program in Christian history at Graduate Theological Union, University of California at Berkeley. He's interested in the Jacksonian era, and he told me that he's hoping to write his PhD dissertation on the Christianization of Freemasonry.
Many years ago, when I was a teenage boy, I shoplifted from a local mini market a silver-plated cross necklace and defiantly wore it to church on the following Sunday. I wore the necklace for the purpose of making a statement to my congregation of my spiritual status. The average person may think these actions strange, Since the sin of stealing undermines the message the cross is generally understood to mean in Christianity today. But I was no typical Christian, and herein lies the answer to the riddle. I was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. As my theft was contrary to accepted LDS behavior, so was my display of the cross. Wearing the cross was an act of rebellion against the ecclesiastical authority and teachings of the church. Having grown older and less rebellious and more responsible since my teenage years, I served a full-time mission for the LDS Church. In the early months of my service, I was again confronted with another apparently paradoxical situation related to the Mormon cross taboo. My companion and I were teaching an investigator who was seriously considering the possibility of joining the church. We encouraged him to read the Book of Mormon, seek the Lord's guidance through prayer, and on the following week, with tears in his eyes, he enthusiastically told us that he had received an answer from God to join the church. The night before, he saw in a dream a cross of flames, which to a convert of, or which to a person coming from Catholicism would make sense. But as a missionary, I was very confused, unsure how to respond. All I could do was raise my eyebrows and ask, "Will you be baptized?" I was happy that he accepted the invitation. However, I remained disturbed over the idea that God would answer a prayer with an apostate sign to direct somebody to come toward the church. "What do you think about Gabriel's dream?" I asked my companion. "I don't know, Elder." My companion seemed to be as confused as I was. I eventually stopped being an active believing member of the LDS Church, but my curiosity of the Mormon cross taboo remained and eventually became the topic of my master's thesis. An expanded version of that will be published soon through John Whitmer Books. There's an image of it right there. Banishing the Cross, the Emergence of a Mormon Taboo. So I will share with you some of my research from that very briefly. When the LDS Church was officially organized in 1830, many citizens of the United States held deep contempt for Catholicism. Mainstream Protestants regarded the Catholic Church, like Mormonism, to be a threat to democracy and Christianity. Tensions increased when Catholics immigrated with great numbers into what was essentially a Protestant nation. Between 1820 and 1850, the Catholic Church grew exponentially from less than 200,000 to a membership of 1.75 million, becoming the largest religious body in the United States. Since canon law prescribed where crosses and crucifixes must appear on Catholic architecture and in architecture, the increased prominence of the cross became infused in the public mind with the fear of Catholic dominion. The cross therefore served as a steady target for anti-Catholic mobs. Mobs would attack Catholicism by aiming the crosshairs, so to speak. According to most American Protestants, the cross was a strictly Catholic symbol. Reports a Boston Episcopalian in 1847, quote, "When a stranger enters a city and passes a church with a cross upon it, his impression is that it is Roman Catholic. And when one visits the cemetery and sees a stone embellished with the same symbol, he takes it for granted that a Roman Catholic sleeps underneath," end of quote. Most Protestants were unwilling to risk the threat of mob violence and dissent from within, and so they avoided crosses that would have otherwise made their churches appear Catholic. The St. Augustine Church, Augustine's church was destroyed by arson in the Philadelphia riots of 1844, and a Boston chapel was attacked by mobs in 1854, having its cross pulled down from the steeple and set ablaze. Am I in the way? Okay, hopefully you can see this. It's kind of a faded photograph. The anti-cross paranoia is graphically illustrated in this pamphlet published in Boston 1855, entitled The Satanic Plot, Awful Crimes of Popery in High and Low Places. Historian Ryan K. Smith describes the pamphlet as follows, quote, "In this pamphlet, championing free schools and Protestant churches, the cover art centered on a discussion between the seated figures of the Pope and Satan on the map of the United States. Not only did the cross appear prominently on the back of the Pope's chair, but it adorned the back of Satan's chair as well. Such a scene left little doubt that Protestant loyalties to the symbol were thin. In these and other images, the cross served as a Catholic trademark, a piece of visual shorthand representing the sensual tools of Catholicism and the oppressive authority of the Catholic Church." End of quote. In the light of information like this, some scholars have proposed that early Mormons simply mirrored contemporary Protestant views of the cross, and that they held on to this anti-cross view longer than Protestants due to the fact that they were isolated in Utah when Protestants had become more accepting of it. This conclusion, although interesting and seems to fit very nicely and sounds quite persuasive, however, was not supported by the evidence I gathered in my studies. The earliest negative statements I found dated between 1877 and 1881. In contrast to this, I found several examples of Mormons actually promoting the symbol of the cross. I found meeting houses built in cruciform designs. Crosses also surrounded windows and attic vents, were illustrated on stained glass windows, engraved on pulpits and gravestones, framed and hung on walls, used decoratively during celebrations, sewn into quilts, drawn as notation symbols, etc. And cross floral arrangements were especially common at funeral services. Here we have a photograph of John Taylor's funeral. There's an anchor and a cross on the left-hand side of the cross. Many saints also wore crosses as jewelry. Here we have Brigham Young's polygamous wife, Harriet Amelia Folsom Young. Several of Brigham Young's daughters wore crosses too, but I'll share one here. Here we have a photo of Nabby Young. See her cross earrings. This one's a little harder to see, but this is Georgia Clausen, daughter of Hiram B. Clausen, who was Brigham Young's son-in-law. And Cedar City's first primary president, Mary Ann Corlett Stewart. Hard to see, but if you look closely, it's kind of funny. There's tack holes in the eyes of the photograph. Apparently, she must not have been very popular among the primary. I don't know. Although cross jewelry was more popular for female members of the church, it wasn't terribly popular, but we do have these photographs that show up with them wearing cross jewelry. Although it's more popular for women, some men also wore crosses on tie tacks and watch chains occasionally. And here we have a picture of a cross hanging underneath the coat of a man posing in a photograph in 1883 titled "The Bishops, Superintendents, and Teachers of the 16th Ward Sunday School." I was surprised to find examples like these. The absence of negative commentary towards a cross prior to 1877 was equally surprising. Three questions naturally followed. Why would early Mormons repeat the same anti-Catholic polemics as Protestants, identifying the Catholic Catholicism as the great abominable, mother of harlots, church of the devil, etc., and yet omit any direct criticism of the cross? Secondly, why did attitudes towards the cross change in Mormon culture to become what it is today? And three, why did it change? Mormonism initially avoided condemning the cross for three fundamental reasons, according to my studies. An involvement in folk magic and Freemasonry both encouraged the use of the cross. And third, the pre-Columbian cross is being found in archaeological remains. So in the minds of many saints, this was evidence confirming the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. So wasn't it in their best interest to discredit the symbol of the cross as something satanic? Here we have a slide of the Smith family magic parchments. Here we have a closer photograph of three crosses that are found on it. This is related to folk magic, treasure seeking, I guess. But in the magic parchments that are associated with the Smith family, the three of them all have crosses on them. They're covered with crosses, actually. And here we have the serpent walking king that Mike Quinn mentioned. You can see, if you look closely, underneath the J and S, an inverted Petrine cross. Now, I believe that this has both magical and Masonic significance associated with the Rod of Aaron. Here's a Masonic serpent staff, a little similar. There are some sources explaining that Masons use these as props, but in Joseph Smith's mind, I think it had magical significance as well. There's plenty of evidence for that. And of course, a slide of a pre-Columbian cross. Okay, when and why did attitudes toward the cross change? By the end of the 19th century, new generations had by and large turned away from their past involvement in folk magic and Freemasonry. The third factor alone, the pre-Columbian cross, was insufficient for Mormons to preserve the general acceptance of the cross, particularly when two more waves of anti-Catholicism hit Utah at the turn of the 20th century and approximately 50 years later. Attitudes polarized among the saints at the grassroots level, manifesting rather loudly in 1916, when the church petitioned the Salt Lake City Council to erect a cross monument on Ensign Peak to honor the Mormon pioneers, who were then quickly dying off, to emphasize not only an appreciation for the Mormon pioneers, but also to stress that Mormons are Christian too. A vocal minority spoke out against the monument design, however, arguing that the cross was a Catholic symbol, mark of the beast, or an abhorrent instrument, merely an abhorrent instrument of capital punishment. Others objected to the cross monument proposal on legal grounds, asserting that the monument would violate the separation of church and state, since the location of the site was public property. Due to this public backlash, coming from within and without the church or outside the church, as well as impending legal battles, the cross monument proposal never came to fruition. But Less than a year later, a small wooden cross was erected at Immigration Canyon, marking where Brigham Young, sick and wearied by the trek, looked across the valley and hillside from Apostle Wilford Woodruff's wagon and proclaimed, "It is enough. This is the place. Drive on." In this photo, it is obvious that the contemporary monument is a cross, and a rather large one, and yet an article describing this calls it an simple and unpretentious signboard. But you'll remember there was a huge backlash over the cross monument proposal on Ensign Peak that this followed. And so it appears that this article is minimizing the description to avoid another public backlash. I have my pages mixed up. I'll just do it from the top of my head. After this happened, there was a polarization in the church. Some brethren continued to hold a positive view of the cross while others didn't. One leader of the church, Spencer W. Kimball, had a positive view of the symbol. He mentions in his diary that when he was called to be an apostle, that he felt extremely inadequate. And he talks about how in 1842, I believe it was, 1842, he was worried. He just didn't know if he was able to do the to fulfill the call. And so he says that he went out and he hiked up a hillside. And as he's describing this event, he compares himself to the Savior and the gospel. And he's pouring his heart out to the Lord, asking for a sign, not for a sign, you know, but a sign that would help bring comfort to his soul. And as he did that, he said he turned around the corner and he saw a natural cross. And he saw this as an omen, a cross formed, I guess, by dead wood limbs. And interestingly, he, in having this experience, felt assured that he was called to be the Lord's representative. A year later, he goes back to the same location and makes the hillside. It's the anniversary of this event in 1843, and he says that he see, or 1943, and he says that he see, he goes back to his cross, and he finds that it's broken. And so he goes back down the hillside and finds a cross arm to rebuild it the best he could. That's in quotes. So after this and plenty of other examples, one would think that there would continue to be a polarization in the church, some holding positive views and others negative toward the symbol. But a decade later, another anti-Catholic wave of tension hit the state of Utah, and it is at this time that President David O. McKay institutionalized the taboo for the cross, defining the cross as an inappropriate for members. Wearing the cross is a Catholic form of worship, he said. Several church authorities and apologists have since recycled early 19th century Protestant anti-Catholic polemics against the cross to justify this aversion. And these are the exact same arguments that Protestants were circulating generations before. These arguments, coupled with the assumption that the cross taboo has always existed, and has always been prevalent in Mormon culture, helped to perpetuate the aversion into the 21st century. Thank you.
Alan Dale Roberts is an award-winning architect. And he is involved, his firm is involved in the renovation, plans for renovations of visitor centers, temple sites, and historic places for the LDS Church. And perhaps the most important thing for this organization is that he's the co-founder of the Sunstone magazine. So I would like to welcome our last presenter today.
Thank you. It is gratifying to be here and celebrate what, by my calculation, is the 33rd Sunstone Symposium in Utah. Of course, it's been held many other places in many other states. And just to satisfy my own curiosity, I'm wondering if anybody in the audience was there at the first symposium held in the Art and Architecture Building at the U of U. Michael, one other, two others, myself, four. Actually, it's a good sign because that means new audience, new people involved. I know many of you have been coming for many years, and it's great to see you. Another unknown fact about Michael Quinn is that in 1966, 45 years ago, Michael, who at the time went by Dennis, was the head resident at my dorm at BYU. So I have known Michael, and we have been friends for 45 years, and how the time flies when you're having fun. I've been asked to talk about Nauvoo Temple, Nauvoo the city. The church has designed and built at considerable expense an accurate exterior and a partially complete interior replica of the Nauvoo Temple. What meaning can we ascribe to that choice and to the church's ongoing work over the last few decades to commit significant human resources and funds to restore or recreate anew and then maintain and operate a large number of historic sites, buildings, and visitor centers throughout the United States and abroad? Then ask yourself the interpretive question, what happens or should happen to the message of history when history is put in the service of the missionary program rather than being valued independently for its own sake? These questions provide the framework for my comments on the church's recent historic sites and temple building efforts. I start with three assertions which I believe to be largely true. The first is that architecture has a direct and enduring impact on the quality of our lives, including our spiritual lives. We spend most of our lives in buildings, and we spend most of our religious lives in religious architecture. When Winston Churchill said that first we shape our buildings and then our buildings shape us, he was speaking to the transformative power of good or poor architecture to inspire or repress human thought and action. In the last decades, neuroscientists have proven what architects have understood for more than a millennium, that our brain's neurons respond more favorably to certain combinations of shapes, proportions, colors, textures, and lighting than others. Take lighting, for example. Tests internationally involving tens of thousands of students have shown that test scores in rooms illuminated by natural light are 18 to 26% higher than the test scores in rooms where the test was taken with artificial light. Thus, this finding alone has direct relevance to LDS meeting house architecture. As you may know, most of the modern meeting houses of the last several decades have no natural light in the chapels. They do in the classrooms, but not in the chapels. Christian architecture from the beginning has been associated with natural light. Think of cathedrals and any other kind of Christian architecture, and yet that's not something we're doing right now. Similarly, buildings with toxic materials inside of them result in a high performance of the occupants. To say it another way, non-toxic interiors result in fewer sick days and higher performance on the part of the occupants. So on the good side, the LDS Church is now designing meeting houses that are LEED certified. LEED is an acronym standing for Leadership in Environmental and Energy Design. And it's a program of the U.S. Green Building Council. So the church is now designing and building sustainable, green, non-toxic, environmentally responsible buildings. I hope this policy, by the way, is extended to temples and all the other church buildings. The second assertion is that all buildings reflect the values of their creators. So what do LDS buildings say about Mormon values? Related to this, How and where we spend church money reflects the church's values. Let's consider Nauvoo as an example. Why build a temple in Nauvoo instead of in one of Illinois' larger population centers? Why even have one there? And if we are building a temple there, why a carefully researched, sensitively designed, and well-crafted reconstruction or recreation of a destroyed historical temple that was large, expensive, built of stone, Greek Revival style? Why make that choice instead of building a typical standard plan, smaller, simpler, more modern, less expensive temple? I think that the church's decision to build that temple in that location was very intentional in that church history and the church's architectural achievements in Nauvoo were the core concept driving that project, despite the greater cost and greater time. Rather than being the exception, the Nauvoo Temple project is consistent with an ongoing pattern of using historic sites and structures to further a variety of church purposes. As we all know here extremely well, history is vitally important to Mormons. It goes far beyond doing genealogical work preparatory to sacred work for the dead. We are an adolescent church compared to many others, 181 years old. Our history is therefore very accessible, and we're proud of our heritage. We are the largest United States-born religion. And I don't know of another religion that produces as many historians and books of history than the LDS Church. In testimony meetings, people bear testimony of historic events and historical characters. It's essential. It's core to Mormon existence. And I can think of no other denomination that can match the LDS Church in its historic preservation, historic sites, work, not only nationally, but internationally. So in your minds, I believe that you can picture these sites. I'm going to just mention some of the church's historic sites. In the northeast, we have the Hill Cumorah, Sacred Grove, the Grand and Publishing House, Palmyre. We have Joseph Smith's birthplace, the Smith Family Farm. There's the Susquehanna sites. Our firm is involved right now in designing a Gothic chapel and some houses that are replications of some of the houses of the church's founding fathers. There are visitor centers in places like Washington, D.C., Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthood restoration sites, the Peter Whitmer log home, and this list could go on and on. In the Midwest, and many of you have seen all of these sites, we have the Kirtland LDS community complex, the store, the inn, even a sawmill, a home, and then the temple itself. We have the Carthage Jail, Independence Temple Lot, Adamon Diamond, Hans Mill, Winter Quarters, the Mormon Trail Center, and many others. And then, of course, the West, and you know these sites very well, Temple Square. We have the Church History Museum, the Family History Center. We have the Relief Society Building. Outside of Salt Lake, we have places like Cove Fort, the Brigham Young Home and Office in St. George, the Jacob Hamlin Home used to be owned by the church, the Devereux House, many tabernacles that have been restored and have visitor centers there, and temples the same, and the Utah list goes on and on. We have outside of Utah, Pipe Springs, the Polynesian Cultural Center, Mormon Battalion Monument, and so forth. And even abroad, we have historic sites that have now been restored by the church in Europe and places in South and Central America. So in addition to these that are official church history sites, there are sites that have been restored and maintained and managed and operated by non-official church groups. One of these would be, this is the place, Heritage Park, which started out as a state park and is now privatized, a recreation or composite reconstruction of a typical Mormon village. We have Cove Fort, that whole complex. It was built in 1867 under the direction of President Hinckley's grandfather, Ira N. Hinckley, and there are now a complex of buildings there. Chesterfield, Idaho, if you haven't been there, it's about 3 hours north of Salt Lake. It was built by 10 Mormon families from Bountiful, 1880, abandoned around 1930. The entire town exists, a ghost town, if you will. The church, the tithing office, the social hall, the school, all the houses, the outbuildings, the general store, it's all there, and the foundation consists of a group of individual Mormons from the area who are preserving and restoring these buildings. These private effort projects have similar goals, but sometimes their own reasons for existing and being perpetuated. I remember a conversation 35 years ago with Leroy Kimball. He was the founder of Nauvoo Restoration, Inc. I had been visiting Nauvoo every couple of years since I was a boy because my father loved history, and I'm from Milwaukee, and so we would make that drive to Nauvoo starting in the 50s, really. And after I became a career historical architect and preservationist, I took the opportunity to ask him a question, and that is why the restored Nauvoo consisted almost entirely of brick buildings. I had found research that indicated that Nauvoo, at the time the Mormons left it, had 1,000 log cabins, 400 wood frame buildings, 300 brick buildings, and a few stone buildings, including the temple. But the restored Nauvoo had almost entirely brick buildings with a couple of log buildings. His answer was pretty stunning to me. He said that his goal was to restore and recreate Nauvoo the way as a high-styled, substantial brick city, the way it would have been had Joseph Smith lived longer. This kind of speculative preservation is not preservation at all. Despite this overly zealous vision, the Nauvoo Restoration Project got off to a good start. Early on, America's leading archaeologists, historians, and architectural historians were brought into Nauvoo as consultants to create a preservation master plan and to develop research reports to guide the restorations of the individual buildings. And so the early work was done at a very high level. However, as the church eventually became involved, priorities changed, and it was decided that if the church was going to expend money there, it had to be justified based on furthering one of the three missions of the church, in this case, the missionary program. So soon the priorities changed, and missionary work trumped historical considerations. All of the professional consultants were released and replaced with missionaries with less expertise. What had been intended as a new Nauvoo History Museum instead was turned into a visitor center. The Masonic Temple was called a cultural hall, and a picture, a mural of the Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir was painted on the interior, later removed. So basically, and I had other examples. Are you signaling time or no? You're not. Okay, you're just wrapped with attention, and I'm getting the stares in the side of my head. anyway, missionaries were then given the right to change the buildings, and so they would want them to look like their homes. So they take out 1840s fireplaces and put up wood paneling, and it was very unfortunate. Things went downhill. But this is not uniquely a Mormon problem. All of the big historical site restorations and reconstructions went through a similar period of trial and error. I'm talking about Sturbridge Village, Plymouth Plantation, Williamsburg, the very famous Rockefeller-funded Williamsburg restoration that started in 1926. A decision was made, for example, to freeze Williamsburg in a moment of time, which was the conclusion of the Continental Congress in the late 1780s, 90s. And so all of the buildings in Williamsburg that post-dated that were torn down, including magnificent Greek Revival temples and other very significant buildings. They were removed because they didn't fit the time period, a practice that would be condemned today. In recent decades, however, academically educated, well-trained, and highly experienced professionals within the church and under the employ of the church have made great strides in creating both accurate historical buildings, restorations and replications, as well as high-quality, locationally sensitive temple designs. So now I'm talking about two things, historical projects and temple designs. The result has been top-quality projects equal to any being done worldwide. Church and historical design staffs are going to great lengths to do research, find local precedents, local materials, design motifs, attention to details, design integrity. They know that members and non-members alike perceive and value authenticity and genuineness. In both good architecture and good history, there is a truth component that is understood by those experiencing it. My final assertion is that the church's best path is to pursue, as in the case of the Nauvoo Temple, both historically accurate design and a high level of design excellence. I've talked with the architects and interior designers who did the Nauvoo Temple project. They worked very laboriously to research photos, the original architectural drawings, the archaeological findings, to make the exterior of the temple as accurate to the original as could be done. The interior, which is not exactly the same as it was because the ritual practice, liturgy, if you will, is somewhat different. Even so, they used original light fixtures, wooden floors with throw rugs. You won't find that in other temples. They used the design for the original baptismal font. So even in the inside, they tried to be as accurate as they could, given that, first and foremost, this was a temple. I was saddened by the recent death of Marion D. Hanks, with whom I had a small acquaintance. It was deemed by many people that one of his significant contributions was the idea, somewhat radical and not entirely popular at the time he introduced it, that the missionaries, that some of the missionaries of the church should be called not to do proselyting at all, but to do human service missions, to do work directly for the world's populace that needed survival more than conversion. He did this in the missions he supervised, and eventually the church came to have service missionaries. My daughter was one. My half-brother was one. I have friends who have gone on missions not for proselyting, but for purposes of direct human services, some of them to church historic sites. I mention this because I think this is a good model for how to approach the sensitive issue of how to use history to further church purposes without distorting that history or having the message not be truthfully consistent with the vehicle or the building that it's in. Those called to serve at church historic sites have a special opportunity to teach historical and architectural truths along with the gospel truths that inspired seekers and then believers to create these stories and buildings in the first place and bring them to reality.
Thank you very much. I think maybe what we'll do just for a few minutes is to see if there's some conversation among the panelists, maybe some questions or observations that you might like to make after hearing the other panelists. And then if we are still live and kicking, we might have some questions from the audience. So I think maybe the best thing to do would be just for the panelists to use the mics on the table. And who would like to begin with some questions or observations, reflections on the other papers? Thank you.
I have a... an observation for Michael Reed, or a question for Michael Reed, and that is, did you find in your, I was really interested in the personal photographs of people who used the cross as a decorative item in wear. Did you find that most of them, to me, looked like they were in their 30s and 40s? Did you find any who were significantly older, who had were continuing to use that in the photographs that you found?
Older as in age, or
yes,
like
in age.
The individual? Yes, I mean a wide range of ages. Very young, you know. There's a drawing of one of Brigham Young's daughters. Very young. I'm guessing about 2 or 3 years old. That is shown having a cross. And then there's some very elderly. I wish I had my notes available in front of me right now, but yes, there's quite a bit.
Yeah, I have a similar question about crosses. As I saw those photographs, I wondered if many of those people had been converts and had that jewelry prior to their conversion and just kept it afterwards, mm-hmm. As opposed to making, you know, an intentional decision to buy crosses. In jewelry after becoming Mormons. And similarly, I've seen a lot of photos of Mormon leaders with a compass and square. There are pictures of Brigham Young with a compass and square motif, Masonic. And some of these he had when he was, you know, quite a bit older, and the church had distanced themselves from Masonry, but it was sort of a lapel pin. And I don't know if it continued to have meaning for him or not, if it was just jewelry that he had and it complemented his suit or something. So I'm not sure how easy it is to prove that because they had a cross that it had really significant meaning, or if it was just jewelry.
Right. I think. Yeah. Thanks. I think what my study did is it traced more of the taboo. It was less about material culture, but I did use material culture to try and determine that. You would think that if it was taboo, that they would avoid the symbol altogether. But there's also lots of statements, you know, that I didn't get a chance to quote. You know, people talking about seeing the sign of the Lord, and that with how they expected, you know, to see a cross in the sky, right? There's plenty of photographs, you know, of all, you know, times to present a taboo at a funeral, right? That's, you'd want to be very careful, right, with what you're... the type of cross floor arrangements that you find. There's lots of newspaper articles that mention these, and in these articles, not only do they mention that there's crosses, but they talk about how beautiful they are and how appropriate they are for the time. Now, there's also a question of, well, who donated them, right? Because it could have been a non-member, right? But I also have examples of representatives from ZCMI, for example, right? Who donated cross flow arrangements. So, yeah, I mean, how far can we get into the minds of people when we're just looking at material culture? I know we have limitations, but I still think we need to make the best judgment we can by the available evidence.
Perhaps as an anecdote, one of the things that surprises sometimes LDS visitors to the temple, the Community of Christ Temple in Independence, is that when they approach from the front of the temple, there is a large cross. When they go into the foyer of the temple, there is a large cross. And we even watch people avoid having to walk in the shadow of the cross on the worshiper's path, because it's hard to avoid, but it's possible to avoid it. It is, at least anecdotally, expressive of the phenomenon of avoidance.
Do you want to add on to the cross conversation?
Well, yes, my question is that the fact that you do have a cross, the only fellow is it's a half cross. You have Moroni with his bugle or his trumpet. I have no idea where the trumpet came from because it has no scriptural basis whatever, but it's sitting up there half across right on top of the steeple where the others are. Now, Michael, I hope you can tell us in your next book how Moroni got his trumpet.
So my question is, are you suggesting that the other trumpet should be coming out the back of his head? Is that what you're saying?
But Michael, I would say probably by 1840, the Gothic revival in Protestantism in America was widespread, and that all sorts of Victorian Protestant ladies were putting crosses on everything. I mean, they made crosses out of their hair. So the cross was highly used in all sorts of Protestant, you know, communities. It was exceedingly fashionable. Right. And so I guess part of my question is, it seems that the cross falls out of Protestant use when it becomes no longer fashionable. And it becomes associated with old-fashioned, old fuddy-duddy, old aunties who might have, you know, cross earrings. Mm-hmm. So, and that's probably among general fashion, I would say in the 1920s. So it's actually quite late that drops out of fashion among WASP Americans. So it's, I would say that probably from 1850 onwards, it's no longer associated with Roman Catholicism. It's on meeting houses all over New England.
Right. And I didn't mean to suggest that Protestants still associate with Catholicism. There definitely was a transition. It seems, though, that the transition of Protestantism has an inverse relationship with LDS attitudes towards the cross. By the time Latter-day Saints stopped using the cross, Protestants had already, by and large, accepted it as a symbol of Christianity. But there is a good book that I would recommend for people who are interested in the more Protestant focus of the cross in the United States, and that's Ryan Kaith Smith's book, Gothic Arches, Latin Crosses. And it has some really good information, I think.
Yeah. Speaking of Moroni and Nauvoo, the original Nauvoo temple had essentially a weather vane. It had Moroni, but he was horizontal, flying instead of upright, and he had a trumpet, but there was also a compass and square on it and a flaming spear. When the visitor center was built, they did a bronze model of the Nauvoo temple, including the Moroni weather vane, but they left off the compass and the square. And so I think, again, it has to do with accuracy, historical accuracy. Is that more important, or is the message that you're trying to convey more important, and avoiding having people ask questions that are problematic? I think that kind of tension, that dynamic exists all the time. Anyway, I just wanted to throw
that
in.
Can I just carry that on a little bit? Because that's our general theme of this session, which has to do with lost. Can you make any reflections on how these decisions are made? I mean, at what point do we lose the Masonic symbols? I mean, what is the...
I'll give you another example. It happened last week, but you can't tell anybody.
we swear everyone to silence.
We were designing a Mormon building, and has Moroni on the top. And the renderer... we hired a rendering firm to do an illustration, and it came back with the statue of Moroni, and he had the trumpet in his left hand. And we sent that in, submitted that. When we had our follow-up design review meeting, we were taken to task for having the trumpet in the left hand, and I asked somewhat irreverently, how do we know that Moroni was right-handed? And nobody had the answer to that, but somebody, at some middleman level, right on the spot, made a decision that Moroni always has to have the trumpet in the right hand. So in 1978 or 9, I wrote an article for Sunstone called "Where Are the All-Seeing Eyes? The Rise and Decline of Early Mormon Symbolism." I know at least Michael's read it. There's one person that's read it because he wrote me a letter. But the early Mormon symbolism that was used graphically in architecture, like on buildings, on stationery, barrels of, flour, used on signage above ZCMI co-op buildings, you had the same group of symbols, all-seeing eye, clasped hands, holiness to the Lord, the beehive, and some others. Never have I found any crosses produced by the church. So institutionally, I've never found a cross. So maybe these crosses were individual expressions more than institutional ones. But these were 19th century symbols, and I never could find a single symbol that didn't originate in Freemasonry symbolism. And it was odd to me at the time because I thought, well, if I was an architect or a graphic designer back then, why wouldn't I have used symbols from the Book of Mormon? You've got some wonderfully visual image. What about the Liahona? What about the Iron Rod, the Urim and Thummim, the Book of Mormon itself? I mean, there are all kinds of things that could have been used, but none of those were used. Just these other symbols that some people would say, well, they came out of the New Testament, the apologists, and others would say they came out of Freemasonry. But by the end of the 19th century, going into the early 20th century, virtually all those symbols disappeared. And so now you have the church office building with a bas-relief of the world, you know. And so the symbol is, we're a world religion. Mm-hmm. So new symbols are created to express current messages, and old symbols die out if they reflect problematic or anachronistic ideas.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Camilla? Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if anybody knows what happened to the Maya Made Rose, and now there are all the CTR rings and jewelry. And one of the reasons that this is interesting to me is that we have a Catholic friend whose sister's children are Mormons, and she wanted to get them jewelry when they were baptized. And she was asking me what she could get them because she knew the cross would not be right. And so, you know, I looked up online and got some little CTR things that she could give. But I'm just wondering what's going on with Mormon jewelry now.
There was a fair of Mormon products that I did a review of. It was kind of a humor piece back in Sunstone. And you would not believe all the things that are produced for consumption by the church. I said, I'm a child of God, belt buckles. I'm not kidding. I mean, there are those and thousands of other kind of kitschy things that go into some of these novelty stores in Utah. And you'll find an amazing display of things. Some of them are incomprehensible. You know, how could anybody do these things? But some of these decisions just are quixotic. I'm thinking, where did the name of the Golden Green Ball come from? You know, well, it came from a discussion. Mrs. Alfred McCune was on the board, and she and the other members were meeting in her the bedroom of the McCune Mansion having a meeting, and they decided to have this annual dance, and they kept coming up with ideas for what to call it, and they couldn't agree. And so finally somebody looked at the fireplace, and it had marble with golden green stripes running through it, and they said, let's just call it the Golden Green Ball. And that's how that came into existence. So, you know, it sometimes these things are just kind of, you know, fluky.
George?
Symbols of enchantment, which Dr. Luffman, you brought up earlier, and how do they correlate with feelings of possession, which have been discussed in certainly among Mormon missionaries? You've heard stories, perhaps, where somebody would be on a mission in England, and a missionary would be possessed by something, and then there'd be missionaries gather around and pray and command whatever it was to leave, and then it left. And these are certainly in the undercurrent of stories. But I'm wondering about physical symbols of enchantment and circles and the various things calling forth spirits to find treasures, and how that might have led in to issues of possession, and have those diminished. We don't have the physical symbols so much anymore, And I'm wondering if we still in the, at least in the LDS Church, I don't know about the Church of Christ, have rumors or stories or traditions of actual spirit possession, that kind of thing. Has that left us entirely? Are they related? Maybe Michael, are you, I don't know who knows about that, or Dale?
I'm not sure they belong to the, actually, and correlate to each other's world. The enchanted world that I was trying to describe was the vast, different world than which we inhabit. I think if you experience particularly more evangelical Christianity in this country, and particularly in the Southern Hemisphere, where particularly Pentecostal Christianity is ablaze, you will find the kind of demon possessions, spirit identified thing just prevalent everywhere, in which that kind of worldview exists, and the casting out of evil spirits or demons or possession certainly would play significantly. I think that sometimes creeps into what I would describe as American Christianity, kind of through the back door of evangelical Protestantism, and finds itself expressed. Certainly, I think both the LDS and the Community of Christ tradition has a tradition of laying on hands and praying for the sick, and certainly that tradition would have an interface and reports that are similar to what you have shared would occur at gatherings or even in a congregation in concern for or expression of a particular ministry extended to an individual in prayer. I don't think that's an anomaly by any sense of the word. But I guess what I was talking about was, in terms of the enchanted world, was a whole world view, a world that is peculiar to us because we've never inhabited it. And it's peculiar to the movement because that world got domesticated very quickly as the church organized. And a part of it, I don't think it was intentional respectability, but the very nature of the world was changing so rapidly. And the movement of the saints from upper New York to Kirtland, Ohio, and the migrations changed the character of the ground in which the church was finding its expressions.
Mike, do you want to make any comments on that? I'm going to take one more question, and I'm going to make you guys arm wrestle to see who I'm going to pick on, because it's getting late, and we all need to go to sleep. The one in the front. You won.
I had two questions getting back.
No,
to
one.
Just one. I don't know which one to add. Well, I guess I'll direct it toward Dale, and it goes back to when he brought up the issue about the cross on the Independence Temple. And I know that from my reading of the history of the RLDS, now the Community of Christ, is that you didn't have the same problem or issues with the cross at the Salt Lake, you know, that the Utah Church has had, and looking at some of the, when did crosses start to appear on your meeting houses? I've seen some early pictures, and it seems like they go back fairly early into the 20th century. And was there a time when you kind of had the same attitude as the Utah Church, where you tried, you know, deliberately avoided the cross, and then how and why did it change?
Where is Mark Shear when I need him? I am.
Do you want to get some help from your friend?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Michael, do you have?
Yeah, there was some negativity it was more polarized in the church. But yeah, you do find crosses early on. Why that happened? I mean, I think it was, you know, for some of the reasons, same reasons that early Mormons were okay with the cross. It just carried over. But also, in particular, the Strangites. They were probably the most positive towards the symbol of the cross. In their Order of Illuminati, part of their quasi-Masonic ritual, they would have the open Bible, and they would put the cross inside it, and they would swear their oaths on it. It was also said that when this ritual was delivered to Strang, that there was a cross-carrying angel that did it, right? And then when Strang has that event where he's anointed, I guess, king or whatever, that he then there's certain accounts that talk about how there are these canvases with a depiction of somebody, probably the angel, carrying a cross. And so I think there was some extra positivity towards the cross that happened, at least in part, because of a mass conversion that happened after there was the fallout with the Strangites, with the struggles that the Strangites had after James Strang was killed and didn't appoint a successor.
Yeah, I think I'd like to play on what he said and then another anecdote. One of the things that even Community of Christ members failed to recognize early on is many of the people who came into the early reorganization had at least spent a week or two with the Strangites. And usually it was about a week or two. It wasn't any longer than that. And it was, I think there were some things about the enchanted world, of the mystical experience, things of the more charismatic of Joseph Smith that they saw in James Strang that attracted them initially. And so I think that was the attachment. That could have been a carryover. I do remember as a boy not seeing as many crosses in Community of Christ settings as I do today. What we would see in the front of many of our churches behind the pulpit would be a picture of Solomon's depiction of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. The head of Christ.
Right? The head of Christ. Yeah. And it was Solomon's picture. I mean, it wasn't other paintings. It was, and that was almost an icon. But you would see crosses around, but they wouldn't be behind the pulpit. They would be on the pulpit or on a table or in some other place. But increasingly they became more predominant. They were never, that I saw, anyone say, crosses are evil, they ought to be taken out of the church. Yeah.
Can I add to that?
One quick comment.
Okay. Roy Chaville might be one example. When the Chaville Chapel was going to be erected, he made a declaration saying that if there's a cross on that building, if you put a crucifix or a cross on that building, take my name off of it. And so, what's that? Chaville.
The Chaville Chapel is located on Graceland University as the place of worship. But Chaville was an anomaly, and not a lot of times Chaville would make comments of which not two other people in the church would agree with him.
Right.
So.
But the Stone Church Inn.
I think we need to say thank you.
Okay.
And so that we can all get home safely. Thank you all for a wonderful symposium. Do you want to make any comments or? Okay.
Thanks.
I think we may have had an 18 to 26% better symposium experience in a venue with natural light. Thanks for that, Alan. The after party starts now. So if you want to head on over to our house, the address is in the program. And there is one other post-symposium event. If you feel that you have not heard enough from Mike Quinn, there is a dinner and interview being sponsored by the Mormon Stories Organization on Friday, August 12th. And if you're in town and can make that, you can find out how to RSVP, register at mormonstories.org. So we will end with Robin Linkhart giving us a benediction, and then we will disperse.
Creator God, giver of love and light and life, We come to the end of our time together, and our hearts are filled with thanks. In these few days, in the company of old friends and new, we've stretched our minds, expanded our imaginations, exchanged ideas, wrestled with truth, released creativity, challenged the status quo, and nurtured our capacity to love. To love as you love us, with boundless grace. In this space of time, we have truly sensed your presence among us. Thank you. We leave this place better for what we have shared. Bless us as we go. Bless us as we travel. Bless us as we seek to make a difference in our world. Bless us till we meet again. This is my prayer in the name of Jesus Christ, who showed us the way. Amen.